Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Welcome to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and on the web at abc.net.au/rn. What comes after global warming? I bet that's not a question you've thought much about. We are understandably preoccupied with carbon emissions, what we should do to reduce them, and what will happen to the planet if we don't. The long view extends about as far as the end of the 21st century. How many of you have contemplated when the next ice age will arrive, and what the world will look like in 100,000 years' time? Will humans even exist? These are the questions that interest Kurt Steiger. He's a climate historian, an ecologist, and paleoclimatologist and science writer. Kurt looks at climate patterns over thousands, even millions of years. His latest book is called Deep Future: The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. In it, he writes of global warming followed by global cooling. Climate whiplash, he calls it. And if you think there's plenty to worry about with the warming of the planet, well, it's pretty small beer compared to the next ice age. The good news, if you can call it that, is that human behaviour may well have pushed back the next ice age. And also, some parts of the world may well be more hospitable when the polar ice caps melt. Kurt Steiger is speaking here at the Brisbane Ideas Festival.
Thanks, Bob. Well, thank you so much for coming out on a Saturday night when you could be at the ball or the music. And I'll try to make this as interesting as possible. You don't often hear about climate change in the future over such large timescales. And I'd like to introduce you to some aspects of climate change that you don't normally hear about in the media. I'll reassure you from the outset what the talk is not about. I suspect some of you may have come here thinking that this would be kind of the same old cultural divide, political arguments about whether global warming is real or if humans are causing it and things like that. It's not about that. My background is as a climate historian, and I study natural climate changes and cycles and things like that. So what I'll be doing is introducing you to the latest views of where the global warming thing will be leading us, also looking to the past for lessons to say what that might actually be like. So I'd first like to tell you about a term here that's entered the scientific lexicon now, sort of demonstrating the certainty we have of the human impacts on the planet. And if you make this list of not just the climate effects and the greenhouse gases building up, but the extinctions of species, the invasive species, the way we're altering landscapes and making chemical signals around the world that are being now laid down in sediment layers for future geologists to dig up, a lot of scientists have decided, well, when we talk about the history of the Earth, we basically have this large span of time, and we've broken it up into blocks of time that we call epochs. And we characterize them based on what species may have been around or what climatic changes may have happened. So you'll have things like the Eocene epoch and the Pliocene epoch and Holocene epoch based on those kinds of things. And people have gotten together and said, well, by any of those definitions, these are large enough changes of a geological scale to merit being called its own new epoch. And so using the terminology of that, kind of in the tradition of talking about the age of dinosaurs, the age of mammals, we're now talking about the age of humans, where we're so numerous, our technology is so powerful, and we're so interconnected now that we've become a geologic force of nature. And so there's a technical term now, maybe some of you have started to hear this, even if you're not in the scientific circles. We're calling this the Anthropocene epoch right now, or Anthropocene. It basically translates to the age of humans. That's Gene Stormer, an ecologist who first came up with the term. Another term I should point out very quickly too, because I'm going to be talking about climate changes over thousands of years, you could legitimately ask, how can you even consider talking about a prediction of climate that far in advance if you can't even predict the weather next week? And I want to make sure that the terms are clear here. I'm actually not talking about weather that far in the future, because you're right, you can't predict it that far in advance. Climate is a different thing. It's a broad brush average over large areas and long time periods, whereas weather is a here and now phenomenon that's a lot more random. So it's kind of like looking at this picture of the road here. where the long upward journey to the top of the ridge there is a climate trend of going up. But you'll have ups and downs along the way, and that's weather. So what I'll be talking about tonight is climate change over long time periods. And actually, oddly enough, if you talk on large enough scales like this of the whole planet and large blocks of time, it's actually easier to predict in a broad brush sense what's coming down the pike instead of trying to nail down specifics of exactly what happens where. So hopefully I'll be able to convince you of that. The other thing that I'll be trying to do is introduce you to larger timescales than we normally think about. So as I said, I'm a climate historian. I'm used to talking about millions of years or thousands of years. And realizing, of course, that that's not the time scale that most of us live our lives on. You know, for most folks, you know, the end of the workday is forever. Or a student, you know, the end of class, you know. When we've heard people talking about not only modern climate change, but where it will lead us if we don't do anything or, you know, whatever, usually the predictions go into the future and consider a long-term view of the future to be 100 years. And they'll say, if we don't do this or if we do that, within 100 years, by 2100 AD, we'll have these conditions, and here's what the computer models tell us. What I'd like to do is move on from that and ask what to someone like me seems like an obvious question. 100 years doesn't seem like a long time for a climate historian. And the first thing I would want to ask is, well, why are we stopping at 2100 AD as if it's just the edge of a horizon beyond which there's nothing to imagine? What's over that ridge of 2100 AD? That's like almost like in the old days when we had maps of the world and they'd say, don't sail your ship out to that horizon because there'd be dragons out there, or you'll fall off the edge of the earth. I'd like to take you over that edge of the earth into the future and hopefully convince you that what we can see there actually has some merit to it and some weight to it. So basically the way this handful of scientists around the world is getting at this is asking a pretty basic question, which may not have occurred to a lot of folks until now. They're basically asking, where does the carbon dioxide, the heat-trapping gas, where does it go once it leaves our tailpipes and our smokestacks? And now, of course, it doesn't just go out into space right up, you know, infinitely up or anything like that. It's held by gravity close to the Earth. So it doesn't go very far when it blows downwind from where we are. It just goes to another part of the world. So that's the fundamental question that we can now build the picture of the future around. And as it turns out, the geochemists that study this say that most of the carbon dioxide that we emit is going to eventually end up dissolving in the oceans just by down through the surface, because gases in the atmosphere do that naturally. It's how oxygen gets in the water for fish to breathe, and carbon dioxide goes in there. So that's the ultimate destination. But if you add up how much seawater there is in the world and how carbon dioxide gets into it, what we find out is the oceans will absorb most of it, but they can't take all of it up. There's between a quarter and a fifth of it that the oceans will not be able to take, and that fraction will be left stranded in the air for a very long time. Eventually, it will be absorbed and there will be a recovery. It'll be done by some of these reactions, and won't get into great detail, but the basic story is up in that upper panel up there. It's just that the carbon dioxide dissolves in rain. It makes a weak acid. It's called carbonic acid, so it's in solution. It hits limestone or granite or rocks and soils, has a chemical reaction with them, and ends up crumbling the rock a bit. And all that stuff gets into groundwater and streams. So the carbon atoms that were floating in the air are now in the water. They flow downhill, and they end up in the ocean too. Well, when that happens, that form of the carbon acts kind of like an antacid pill for the great banquet on carbon dioxide that the ocean has been going through. And the ocean can now absorb even more CO2 from the air, the more of that mineral stuff goes in. So eventually it does end up in the ocean, but it may have to go through this second step of reacting with the rocks and the soils. And as you'll see up here, it's a very long, slow process to remove this stuff from the air. So assuming that we aren't going to do some high-tech, costly way of pulling carbon dioxide out of the air artificially, we're probably going to leave it to the oceans and the rocks. If we do, it doesn't take just decades, it doesn't take just centuries like we had been thinking before. When you go through the bookkeeping of this, we find it takes thousands of years for this recovery. So basically, the gist of it then is the changes we're setting in motion now are of immense duration, not just in, you know, intense severity, but they're going to last a really, really long time. That's pretty shocking. Now, this term climate whiplash is something I just came up with, and I basically came up with the idea after reading some of these nerdy scientific papers with their graphs and such talking about this, and it really kind of made common sense what they were saying, first of all, about where the stuff goes. But then they had another point. They said, basically, what goes up must come down. At some point, we're going to stop emitting so much carbon dioxide, either soon, because we switch to non-carbon fuels quickly in the next few decades, or some later time, and in the most extreme case, it's because we just go on as usual until we burn it all up, and then we're forced to switch. So at some point, we're going to not emit so much. So let me just sort of point to this graph right here. Here's time, there's the present day, and there's the future. There are no numbers on it or anything, but this arrow is showing that what we're on now is where the arrow is going up, and that's our carbon dioxide emissions are going up. Well, at some point, they're going to level off for those reasons I was telling you. We're either going to switch or we're going to run out and then have to switch. So it's going to reach a peak and then drop back down again at some point. Well, as our emission rate peaks and starts to drop off, so will the amount that's in the air. It's not going to go up forever. There's not an endless supply of carbon to do this with. There's going to be a point that's going to follow. So this next bump goes like that. And because the carbon dioxide traps heat, the temperatures are going to do the same thing too. There has to be some point where we've gotten as hot as it's going to get, and then it's going to flip into a recovery mode like that, which actually, although the temperature's higher than it is now, will be recovering and dropping again closer to normal. So it would actually be a cooling from that higher temperature right there. And so when I talk about the whiplash thing, it's that all the adaptive strategies that we and other species have been having to get used to this or to deal with this warming that we're so focused on right now, when that peak comes and flips into the recovery mode, then all of those adaptive strategies will be obsolete and they're going to have to deal with the opposite kinds of change, which if you think about it, can be just as stressful. It's the climatic change or the environmental changes themselves that puts stress on people and cultures and ecosystems. So there's a lot more to the global warming story than the global warming. There's this very interesting turnaround time where you get the change in the CO2 followed by a peak in temperature, and then what I have here in the last part is even as the temperature peaks and starts to come down, it's still hotter than it is now, so the ice sheets are still melting and the ocean is still rising. So we'll have this odd thing in the whiplash time when you'll have temperatures falling, but sea levels still going up till that finally comes into line too. So to me, it was like, wow, we've been talking about this global warming thing, and it's just like talking about the first page in a book that's really long, and we've only spoken about the introductory part, not realizing that we're setting a lot more things in motion than just the warming. There's this whiplash phase that's going to be very interesting, and then the recovery phase is also potentially stressful too. So this will be the last graph I'll show you. This is what one of the things that made me want to write the book. There are several dozen peer-reviewed papers now out in the literature. They've been coming out the last 5 years or so, and they all basically show pretty much the same thing. So I've compiled all their stuff into one graph. That alone should be of interest because these laboratories that do this work are scattered around the whole planet, and in a sense, they're competitors with each other. So if there was a flaw in the thinking or the modeling in any one of these models, the others would be sure to point it out and disagree with it and try to replace it, but they're all very consistent. So what we have here is time going this way. Here's the present day, and there's 10,000 years in the future, 20, 30, 40, all the way out to 100,000 years. So right away, this gets my attention. This is the time scale that ice ages happen on, not just something that we're doing, but this is just shocking that our legacy can last that long. Now, what I've got here is the amount of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the air. So what I've done was map out what the computer models are saying about two possible paths we could take into the future. One is if we switch quickly away from the fossil fuels to the alternatives, which even if you don't believe this climatic story, we have lots of good reasons for doing, for energy security and economic reasons and things like that too. Anyway, if we switch quickly in the next few decades, then the carbon dioxide story will follow this dotted line. So this is the amount of CO2 in the air. And the star is about where we are now. It's just below 400 parts per million, which isn't very much. The air in the room here has about that much. If we go down the moderate path, then our emissions will peak relatively soon, and we can expect probably to have between 550 and 600 parts per million CO2 at the maximum. Then, as you may be able to see here, this dotted line drops pretty quickly. That's from the oceans soaking that stuff up. And it'll take, actually, a couple of thousand years to do that. But the other thing to notice is, here it's very steep, and then it doesn't come all the way back down to today. It actually levels off, and this is actually before the Industrial Revolution. Anyhow, look at this. It just keeps going and going very, very slowly, getting rid of the last dregs of that stuff. In our best-case scenario, it's probably going to take about 100,000 years to recover in the best case scenario from what we're doing now. So let me just say at the outset, don't let that paralyze you with despair and make you jump off a bridge. It's too late to do anything because we have a choice to make. Yes, these are huge changes that we're setting in motion. We're locked into this already, but notice it's not that severe. And the alternative, if we don't do something and switch as quickly as possible, if we burn all of the coal, oil, and gas we've got in the next few centuries, then that solid line is what we head for. And it can get as high as maybe almost 2,000 parts per million in the air. And the more stuff, of course, the warmer it would get. The other thing to notice is, look at that. It's like a sharp spike in how dramatic that warming is that will follow that, and then a rapid turnaround, and then a rapid cooling for probably 5,000 years of dramatic changes, including the whiplash. And then the ocean has taken up as much as it can. This is the rocks and soils trying to clean up the last dregs of it. And notice this, it goes right off the scale. It doesn't even come back down to normal in 100,000 years. This doesn't come down all the way until about 500,000 years. So that's the choice. And the most amazing thing, I think, for me is not only just the scientific interest of having that far a future to deal with, but that this is the critical time where the decision's going to be made. It's in basically our lifetime. The next several decades, or basically this century, the decision will be made whether the climate disruptions last 100,000 years or 500,000 years.
Kurt Steiger, paleoclimatologist, ecologist and science writer, speaking at the recent Brisbane Ideas Festival. You're with Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay, on ABC Radio National. Kurt Steiger's latest book is Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. And here he talks about some climate scenarios into the deep future.
If we switch quickly away from the fossil fuels, we can maybe hope to get to 550, 600 parts per million CO2, probably end up with 2 or 3 degrees centigrade global warming from that eventually. Looking back to history, we've had that happen many times in the past. Every time you have an ice age, it eventually comes to an end, and there's a natural global warming that follows that for thousands of years, and then another ice age comes, and they've been doing this for the last 2-3 million years, just in natural cycles. Well, those natural warm times between the ice ages, we call interglacials, they're very similar to what we would look for if we do the moderate case. And we've actually got very good historical records from rocks and fossils and soils to show us what that would be like. So, for example, if we go back in time before the last ice age, about 130,000 years ago, You could have gone to Northern Europe. If you went up to England, let's say, those are the White Cliffs of Dover 130,000 years ago. You would have encountered elephants, hippos, water buffalo, a lot of the animals you normally would associate with Africa, tromping around and bothering people probably in England and Germany. They were, you know, water buffalo drinking from the Rhine River and things. It's because it was warm enough up there that tropical type animals moved north into those habitats. When you warm the planet like that, more water evaporates into the air from the oceans, and also the circulation of the atmosphere gets more intense. So you get stronger monsoons and basically more rainfall, especially in the tropics. So at that time, the Sahara Desert was basically green, and there were gigantic lakes and rivers out there that you can now see the remains of out there in the desert. So it was wetter and greener in a lot of the tropics. Where Carrie and I live in a northern state of New York, up near the Canadian border in the States, our forests were quite different. They were actually like forests from the deep south down in Georgia and the Carolinas. And we know that from the pollen of the vegetation that has fallen into the lake sediments that you can dig up and examine under a microscope. So basically the story then is you make the tropics warmer and greener, and animals and plants basically move closer to the poles because it's warmer up there and they're comfortable there. It was warmer than now by a couple of degrees, maybe even 3 degrees centigrade, for about 13,000 years in that last interglacial. That's a long time. And during that warmer time, there was a lot of melting up in the Arctic, as you might expect, just as there is around Greenland now. But what you may not have heard as we talk about the dramatic melting that we're measuring and how fast it's going in Greenland, especially around the edges, we often don't put that in the context of how big the Greenland ice sheet is, or these other big ice sheets. They're enormous. So even though large amounts of melt is happening, it takes thousands of years for those things to melt away. So the last interglacials did not destroy Greenland. It was no more than a third to a half of it melted during the last interglacial. So we could maybe expect something like that also to happen if we get the moderate case. And of course, if you do melt, you know, a half of Greenland and a lot of West Antarctica, sea level does come up and you also warm the ocean. And we've got very good evidence that that happens too. In fact, Western Australia is one of the classic sites for this. If you go around Perth and Rottnest Island, you can see old coral reefs that were growing in position almost 10 meters above sea level now, where the ocean was during that warmer time. Now the sea level has dropped and exposed them, and they're just fossilized. Also, South Africa, where I've done a lot of my work, up near Durban, you're on the beach there. There's some big boulders, and way up on top are fossilized oysters that used to be underwater from that time, too. By the way, Eemian is the geologic name of that warm time. So for folks that may think the possibility of sea level rise, of glacial melting, of global warming happening at all, if people are doubting that and thinking that maybe our predictions are not founded in good science, this should very well illustrate that this absolutely can happen because it's happened naturally even without us helping it. So all of these are very realistic. And perhaps surprisingly, even the extreme situation has happened before. Again, this is way before there were people. There were humans in those interglacials, the last interglacial. This is 55 million years ago, relatively shortly after the demise of the dinosaurs. There was a somewhat unexplained, massive, natural global warming that was actually a super greenhouse that warmed about as quickly as what we could do. It lasted thousands of years, about the time scale of what we would do. One idea for what caused it was these methane ices you may have heard about in permafrost in the deep sea. Something made those come out, probably maybe eruptions in the Atlantic and also burning the organic mud at the bottom of the sea. We're not sure, but a large amount went into the air and then it sort of started these feedbacks where the warming caused increased decay and other processes to add on to make it a super greenhouse, which is kind of what we would be afraid we would set in motion in similar manner. When that happened, we have geologic evidence of what the world was like. There was no ice at the poles. The Arctic Ocean was completely ice-free, just like we say we may be doing soon. It was warm enough you could have gone swimming there in the summer and barely shivered. basically anything that required a cold weather habitat would have been wiped out. Polar bears and all actually made it through the interglacial, but they wouldn't have made it through this. We don't know exactly what animals and plants would enjoy this kind of a situation because it's so far back in time, but we do know vegetation was found pole to pole. And we also know mammals in general, although they were early mammals, like back then whales had legs and were walking around on land. You know, none of our modern species were around then, but the mammals that were there seemed to do fine and they lived pretty much anywhere. So they actually liked it, I guess. As I said, there was vegetation from pole to pole. If you went up to the Arctic, you can still find the trunks, not just fossilized, but actually mummified, actual tree trunks of redwood forests that lived up right up to the edge of the Arctic Ocean, all the way around the polar regions. So it was a very lush habitat for things that like warm, lush habitats, and of course it would have been terrible for anything that liked cold habitats. When you lose all of the polar ice, of course that goes in the ocean, and sea level came up about 230 feet or 70 meters basically. If that happened today over thousands of years with the way continents are today, this is what the world would look like. If you know your United States geography, there's a state of Florida that's gone if you raise sea level that much. So to sum that up then, the global warming that we hear about now is absolutely realistic. It's happened without humans before in the past. But it's interesting that this is just the first stage of the whole process. And now we talk about the warming making glaciers melt and retreat and things like this. And isn't that shocking that that can happen? But remember, the next chapter of the story will be much longer. And that's when what then will seem normal to have such a warm climate. When that starts to recover, that will be experienced as a cooling down to what we think of as normal, but not what people in the future will think of as normal. And so ice sheets and glaciers will start growing again. And maybe if people have built their towns near those, they'll be afraid of these things coming down and crushing them. So my point is, most likely it's the change itself that's really the stress, not necessarily warming itself, but this should hopefully show that a rapid changes or cooling could be just as difficult to deal with as well. Now, taking these lessons from history, the things that got through these natural changes in the past pretty much did so by adapting, keeping up with the changes, and also by moving to their preferred habitat spaces. So like your coral reef, sea level's coming up because it's warming, you know, your strategy is to, you know, you're growing as quick as you can to keep up with the shallows. And then of course in the recovery time when the sea level is falling too, which it also does naturally, then you've got to deal with maybe growing at greater depths or out to the sides. But adapting to these things and moving around is what enabled a lot of species to deal with these changes in the past. The difference now, which I argue does not allow us to say, yes, these have all happened in the past, everything was fine in the past, so why do we care? It's different now, because this is a world with humans all over it. This is the Anthropocene epoch. So species that needed to migrate in the past had nothing in their way to block that migration. Now, our cities, roads, farms, settlements are in the way, and things are trapped, and it'll be a lot more difficult for that migration strategy to work. I'm actually more concerned about other species than I am about humans in terms of extinction because of this, from these changes. I should also add, there's more to global warming than what we've been talking about, not just the whiplash, not just the cooling that follows and the large timescales. There's a whole other aspect that I'll just mention briefly here. I'm not sure how many of you have heard about this. It's basically what happens to the oceans. It's a chemical change that happens that's separate from the climate issue altogether. The climate will eventually recover, but the problem is, as the oceans soak up the carbon dioxide from the air, the carbon dioxide dissolves in the water, makes carbonic acid like it does in rain, and that upsets the chemical balance of the oceans, such that any animal that has a hard part that can dissolve, so the shell of a snail, or a sea urchin, or a crab, or a prawn, or the hard parts of corals can dissolve when the acidity increases. And this problem of ocean acidification is considered easily as important as the climatic effects. And it's already being observed. It's happening observably in the poles. We can see the corrosion of the shells of some of the plankton species already around the polar regions. The next target, if we keep increasing the amount of CO2, the acidity will spread to the bottom of the sea where it's very cold. The polar water will go down there. The productive fisheries in the upwelling zones will go next. And if we go down the extreme path, it will begin to affect the tropical regions, which would be the last ones affected. And so the Great Barrier Reef and places like that would be also vulnerable. As I said, I hope you don't go depressed from here. That's about the low point of the talk, I should let you know. And by now, some of you may be wondering, like, why do I need to worry about this? Or why should I even care about this? People aren't going to be around in 100,000 years. So who cares if our things are going to last that long? How many of you in the room believe that humans are going to be around in 100,000 years? I make a case that I think we will be. And I think that's an important question to ask because, as I said, if we're not going to be around, then who cares about this at all? I think we're going to be around, or our descendants will be around, and that's one of the reasons why this is important to consider the long view. Now, let me give you the case really quickly. I just figured, all right, well, what could really wipe everybody out? Okay, now, I'm not belittling the suffering that could come with these changes. I'm not talking about population declines or local extinctions of people. I'm talking about total global extinction of Homo sapiens. What could make that happen so that there would not be people here in 100,000 years? So I just came up with my own list. Okay, disease. Like, you take the worst plagues in history that we know about, like bubonic plague killed half of Europe and things like that. Of course, when we talk about the magnitude of such a disaster, it kills half of Europe, we forget that that also means half of Europe survived this centuries ago without modern medicine. It's difficult to kill an entire species with a disease when they're numerous, partly because some individuals always have a natural, just by chance, a natural resistance. I doubt disease could really kill all of us. We may have some big problems with it, but I don't think that's going to absolve us from having to experience these changes. Nuclear war, with fingers crossed, I hopefully think we won't do it. I think for it to really kill everybody, including you Australians down here in the Southern Hemisphere, lots of countries would have to agree cooperatively to have a massive nuclear war, to have enough stuff going off to really kill everybody. And if we can cooperate that much to have a self-extinction event, then I would think maybe we could convince ourselves not to do it at all. So let's just hope that one doesn't happen. I doubt that it would. And the last one would be an asteroid, big enough to not just smush a few cities, but melt the whole surface of the planet so the people on the other side of the planet do get killed and all this stuff. It would have to be huge to really get all of us. And astrophysicists I've read about say there are none large enough in the solar system to do that in the next 100,000 years anyway. So with fingers crossed, I make the case that I think there are going to be people around in these timescales, and that's one reason why it's important to at least consider them, especially if we're setting those changes in motion. The reason I didn't put climate change on the list, I'm absolutely sure there's no way climate change will kill everybody on the planet. First of all, we've adapted to climate changes for thousands of years, even with low technology. The other reason is some parts of the world arguably will become more habitable for people as these changes go on. So there will be refuges where some folks could actually do relatively well. And if I was going to vote for one place in the world, I'd say Greenland would be a good candidate. We actually know what's under the ice there. If you do the radar surveys, we find out that the middle of Greenland is below sea level. If the ice is gone, you have a fjord there, a protected harbor, where the sea would come in. You expose the rocks, which are actually full of minerals for gems and valuable metals. You'll expose land for agriculture, where you could then have a thriving source of fresh vegetables and livestock in a place that now has to import it at great expense from Denmark and Europe and places like that. At that time, the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free. There'll be shipping commerce going through there. There'll be fisheries. Greenland would be a great place to move, I would argue, in the far future when it's that much warmer. So I don't see any way people are going to be wiped out in the next 100,000 years. So if you accept my argument, people will live through this.
Kurt Steiger, paleoclimatologist and writer, speaking at the Brisbane Ideas Festival. You're with Big Ideas and me, Paul Barclay. on ABC Radio National.
You have to promise me, though. You know the cliff faces? I don't want you to do that.
Yeah, sure. I mean...
You lie. You...
Absolutely, dear.
On 360 Documentaries, Steve's Diary, a walk through untracked country.
Yeah. Doing all right for a 55-year-old bloke. I'm as walking as good now as I did when I was 30. Yeah, had to push myself. I laid down a couple of times in the thick scrub and I thought of home, family, Alison and my mum. Yeah.
From one of Australia's wild places, join us for the story of a man who walks where there are no paths. 360 Documentaries, Saturday after the news at 2, here on ABC Radio National.
Kurt is giving you the long-term view of climate changes, warming and then rapid cooling, a future where there'll be winners and losers.
So just to sort of go through a little quick buffet of some of these changes we can actually see happening now to show that there's weight to these arguments, we see this happening. Some things are losing, others are being winners in these kinds of changes. It's important to realize, though, that when we get to the whiplash time and the cooling off time, the winners could well become losers in that far future as well. So, you know, you always hear about the polar bears and the ringed seals that need the ice in the Arctic. So as the ice goes, the seals are going and the polar bears are going. But what you don't often hear is when they lose out, this actually represents an opportunity for other species. And as the ring seals are waning, harbor seals are moving in from the North Atlantic and seeing it as a new frontier. And the brown bears and grizzly bears are actually moving north into polar bear territory, even to the point of hybridizing with the polar bears. It's not as simple as a, you know, just a all good or all bad. It's very interesting and very complicated. As we lose the sea ice, we're already losing the microbes and the fish and other animals that are adapted to the ice communities. At the same time as the ice is retreating, the sun is hitting the water, making plankton grow more, and an entirely new food chain is starting to develop up there, even to the point that I'm told Russia is building a fishing fleet ready to take advantage of an open water fishery in the Arctic Ocean as that ice retreats. Or you can follow the geopolitical events. There's a huge land grab going on up in the Arctic, which you may have heard about. Like, for example, the Northwest Passage and another one, the Northern Sea Route along the Russian coast is opening up, allowing trade between Europe and Asia instead of having to go through Panama or the other canals. And so unresolved territorial disputes are now bubbling to the surface as places that were considered unimportant when it was frozen are now becoming important because they're going to be worth money. So I'm not sure if you've heard of this. There's a little rock of an island between Greenland and Ellesmere Island in Canada, and Denmark and Canada have almost come to blows over who owns that because the territory was not clearly defined. And if you own the piece of rock, then you have the fishing and mineral rights for hundreds of miles around it. So basically, they almost came to blows several years ago over this. The Danes would show up with a gunboat. They put up the Danish flag. They put a bottle of schnapps at the bottom of the flag. They leave a sign saying, "Welcome to the Danish island." And then a Canadian gunboat would show up, knock over the flag, drink all the schnapps. I don't know if they left a sign or a Molson's bottle, but that was going on until the boundary line was finally established. And so now they're not going to go to war over that, which was a good thing. I don't know if you've heard that Russia has claimed the North Pole. They put a submersible under the ice and planted a titanium flag on the seafloor right on the North Pole. And they've claimed it for Russia because of the mineral rights and the fishing rights and things like that. It's not officially recognized by the United Nations, but the point here is for those folks who may doubt that the Arctic is becoming ice-free should talk to these people who are about to go to war and are investing heavily economically in this brand new frontier that's probably going to be very lucrative because the ice is retreating. So anyway, I've been trying to stick to facts here for you and avoid too much speculation. One of the big facts is we are going to switch from fossil fuels sooner or later, either by doing it on purpose and getting the alternatives quickly or burning them all and then having to switch. So there's a fact. The switch is going to come. The next fact is how we do it will affect the world for thousands of years. And that's the new information to take away tonight. Another fact is it's not simply all good, all bad. It's complicated. And you need to see the whole picture to really take all of these things into account. Some will gain, some will lose. But then, if you think in the long term, those winners and losers may actually change places later on. And so then it raises ethical questions. How do you weigh the good and the bad? This is where the full long-term view is necessary to do the full evaluation here. So I'll just give you a few examples. Sad to say, although computer models often disagree about what rainfall is going to be in different parts of the world, they all agree that the southern part of Australia and the southern tip of Africa should become drier as the climate warms. So you're already pretty dry now. My climate history research in southern tip of Africa also supports this. When we've had global warmings, it's gotten drier. Coolings make it wetter. And the reason is these white clouds, the winter storms, the rainstorms, and the westerly winds are pulling closer to Antarctica as it warms. Just for various reasons. And the tropical belt actually gets wider. Everything sort of shifts towards Antarctica. And so they'll hit the land masses less often. And as far as we can tell, it's actually starting to happen now. So you could maybe put southern Australia on the list of losers unless you can desalinate a lot of water. My point earlier was just the warming itself is not necessarily the only problem. It's the changes in where the rain is falling or how powerful a drought is or how the temperatures are and things like that that really affect folks. So if you're kind of used to things being a certain way when they change, if you're not resilient and not anticipating them in advance, it can be a major problem. So I'm just contrasting, you know, certain parts of the world or just using Australia as an example. If it gets wetter or drier, it can be an actual problem. And I know, I guess you're having troubles up in the north now as the insect-borne disease, the dengue fever. And of course, you know, when it gets hotter, you may have more of the smog issues. And, of course, the heat waves are stressful and bushfires. It's just the idea that if you intensify or change what's considered normal, any direction of change can be a problem if you're not ready for it. It's certainly true that sea level rise should happen, and it can actually be extreme in the extreme case. But what you don't often hear when you hear how high up it could come is how slow it happens. And this is not to belittle the seriousness of the situation, but I think it is important to point it out. You hear different estimates of how long it would take, but most estimates say it's centuries for these kinds of things to happen. Although there are folks that say it could come up incredibly fast, even they don't say it's like you have to run with the waves chasing you or anything, or you can't leave your kid on the beach to go get an ice cream for him because when you come back they're swept away, or any of that kind of thing. Most of the reliable estimates I've heard from actual glaciologists and sea level experts, they say probably a meter or less per century is what we're looking at. So they're huge changes, but maybe not as deadly fast as what you've been hearing. It's still worth taking it seriously. But it's also interesting to ask, what might it really be like to be in these cities as they're going under? And we actually know, because we've got some. You have places like Venice. Some of the major cities in Asia, like Bangkok, and a lot of the major cities in China are actually sinking faster than sea level rise is coming up just from groundwater extraction. And so what's most likely to probably happen is it takes centuries for it to go all the way under. It's more of a chronic problem than an acute disaster. And maybe in a few cases, some people may actually make a tourist attraction out of it, like Venice. But the last aspect of this, too, is kind of interesting as well. As the cities on the coast start going under, we sometimes joke about how we should invest in land inland because it's going to be oceanfront property someday. That's actually probably going to happen sometimes. And you can see an example of that in Amsterdam, which is now threatened by the sea level rise. But it's important to note, centuries ago, it was completely landlocked and was just a sort of a nondescript village. Natural sea level rise eventually broke in over here and made this harbor, connected Amsterdam to the North Atlantic shipping lanes, and gave it this huge economic boost and made it this great cultural center. So we could actually anticipate the real story will be, even as cities on the coastlines go under, the ones slightly inland may actually be looking with anticipation for a brief honeymoon of a century or two where they get to be the port for a while, and then they go under and the next one's in. It's going to be very interesting and complicated. There's some really interesting things that happen when you think on these timescales. What seems unthinkable now, like an ice-free Arctic, will become normal. And we have to realize that people in the far future may actually not like the recovery as well. When that kind of a situation becomes an ancient normal ecosystem and culture, people may actually be afraid of the refreezing. It's a very strange ethical thing. Another one is, on these timescales, we realize by looking at the natural cycles that we're interfering with future ice ages. The next one from the natural cycles is due in about 50,000 years. If you remember the time scale, our carbon dioxide is going to be around in 50,000 years, and it's just warm enough then to cancel the next ice age. So you can actually say that might be one of the few good things about the stuff we've done, especially if you're a fan of Canada. When you have an ice age, it's a mile-thick sheet of ice totally bulldozing the entire country of Canada and also in Northern Europe as well. So as far as I know, Canadians are not happy about global warming, but in the far future, their descendants might be, to know that we have already prevented the next ice age, which is stunning that we would have that kind of power. So to wrap up here, one of the useful things I think about a long-term view is it may help us actually look for win-win situations where you don't have to say, well, you know, we should burn all our stuff so we prevent more ice ages for people down the line and we'll suffer on their behalf now. Maybe there's some good win-win situations. So if you want to save the planet, save the whales, maybe look for alternative energy sources. I'd encourage you to look up thorium power, which seems to have a lot of potential maybe as a relatively safe version of nuclear power. Could be a good energy source. Kind of tongue-in-cheek in a way. I like to bring up one more good reason to do the right thing and switch quickly to whatever these alternative energy sources might be. I call it save the carbon for later because of this ice age thing. If it's good to have the global warming in the far future but bad now, why don't we have a win-win situation? We leave the carbon in the ground now for all the different reasons that I was trying to present, and then it's nice and safely sequestered in the ground so 100,000 years from now, when an ice age is starting up again, if people decide they don't want to have it, all they have to do, even if they have simple technology, go to the nearest mountain that has coal and light a fire, even if it's just flint and steel or something, and set it on fire. Just like here in New South Wales, here's a mountain that's been burning for 6,000 years from a lightning strike. That's carbon dioxide going into the air, greenhouse gas. Kind of tongue-in-cheek, but one more good reason to make the switch. Save the carbon. So here's the end. The good news is I propose humans will survive. Bad news is many species may not. The reality is we will decide either by acting or doing nothing. You are a force of nature. As I said, we're so numerous, powerful, and so interconnected that we basically have the power to affect the future of the world for so long. It's very important to be well-informed, therefore, because what's in our minds will affect the far future. So I urge you to look for the best information you can and ask the good questions, choose the good ideas and solutions, and support them when you hear them.
Kurt Steiger, author of Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth.